New Hampshire, check. Nevada, next. Then South Carolina, and on March 3rd, Super Tuesday, with California in the mix. On Insight, PolitiFact reporters tackle voter misinformation. Chris Nichols from the California team reviews some of what you should know, and Daniel Funke from the National PolitiFact team addresses some of its fact-checking. Then we'll spotlight young voters across California. Millennials and older Gen Zers have made a difference in Iowa and now in New Hampshire. We'll explore what the impact of the young vote in California might be. Later in the hour, we get a visit from Rick Cushman. He's going to talk about something rather startling that's happening, the softening wine sales across the United States. And as usual, he'll have a bit of Valentine's Day advice, and I predict it'll be something bubbly. I'm Beth Ruyak. That's today on Insight. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruyak. So we now know the results of New Hampshire's primary with Bernie Sanders, now with 28% of precincts reporting, getting 25.8% of the vote. Pete Buttigieg with 24.5%. Amy Klobuchar, 19.8%. Elizabeth Warren in fourth. Joe Biden in fifth. Andrew Yang and Michael Bennett suspended their campaigns yesterday. Deval Patrick is expected to do the same today. So the presidential campaign now moves west, with candidates and their teams planning a number of stops in Nevada and California over the next few weeks. South Carolina's primary is scheduled in between the two. That one is on Leap Day, February 29th. The next Democratic debate is in Las Vegas on February 19th, and that is the same day as Governor Newsom's State of the State address in California. We will bring you live coverage and analysis of Newsom's address immediately following Insight. Today, a PolitiFact conversation about California election misinformation. Reporter Chris Nichols from the PolitiFact California team is with me in the studio. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Beth.
Glad to have you here. Daniel Funke is a reporter for PolitiFact National. He's joining us with some fact-checking from St. Petersburg, Florida. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, Beth. Thanks for having me.
So, Chris, let's start with you and what started the team's focus on misinformation, which is sometimes a place we don't want to go because of confusion.
That's right. Well, we've noticed just a lot of confusion, a lot of false statements, mainly on social media. And this has been for weeks, maybe even months, leading up to what will be California's primary election, March 3rd. And, there's misinformation about how you can vote in California, about who you can vote for, depending on your party affiliation. So we really just wanted to set the record straight, be a place where people can come. The article we published yesterday is really sort of an authority on what's true, what's not when it comes to voting in California.
Californians have their mail-in ballot right now. They're in the process of decision-making. So I think a rolling conversation about possible mix-ups is important right now. Academics think it's important, too.
They do. And we spoke with Rick Hassan. He's a UC Irvine professor who specializes in election law and has really looked at this issue of misinformation spreading on social media. And he said that, combined with other concerns about election, has sort of led to this erosion of trust in the United States when it comes to the election process.
When an election is administered in an incompetent way, as we saw in Iowa, it leads people to worry about the system. They might post information that is false, suggesting that the election was intentionally rigged. These things build on each other and work synergistically to undermine voter confidence in the process. Therefore, it's really important for election administrators to explain what the rules are, to be as transparent as possible, to own up when they make mistakes, and for the media to not sensationalize mistakes and make them into a scandal when they might just be simple human error.
That sounds like an admirable goal, but of course there's a lot of room in there for a lot of errors and misunderstandings.
There is, and as the professor talked about, there is a really important role for election officials, for the media, to provide the best, most accurate information and to counter the false claims that are out there. And I think the biggest topic or the biggest source of confusion that we've noticed so far in California is essentially the rules that govern how no party preference voters can choose candidates in the primary election. There are now more than 5 million no party preference voters in the state. That's the second largest party now in California. There are more of those voters than there are registered Republicans. There are still more Democrats overall in the state. But there's just a lot of bad information saying that these voters, these undeclared voters, can't choose their favorite candidates. And that's just not true. It, you know, it's maybe a little bit more difficult, but there still are avenues for them to go forward. For example, if you want to vote for a Democratic presidential candidate in the March 3rd election and you're a no party preference voter, you do have to request a Democratic Party ballot. You're not going to just automatically be given one. You have to contact your county elections office to do that. If you want to vote for President Trump or any other Republican presidential candidate in the March 3rd primary, and you're a no party preference voter, you have to go and do another step. You have to re-register as a Republican. That's because the Republican Party here in California requires that. So there are, a few extra steps. It might be a little more challenging, but some of these claims that we've seen, these persistent claims and myths about not being allowed to vote for who you want to, are just not right. And so that's something we explore in our article at politifact.com about the primary election here in California.
It does make me wonder if some no party preference voters will bypass that extra step and just turn in their ballot, which means there will be no vote for any presidential candidate. However, there will be votes in other races. You just don't choose in the primary for a candidate.
I think that could happen. I think what also may happen is a lot of, or at least some no party preference voters may show up to a polling place or a vote center on election day and perhaps be surprised that they have to take a couple of extra steps. California this year, a new allowance is that people can go on election day, all the way up to election day and including election day, and register or even switch their registration to a different party on election day at their polling places and vote centers. That is a new allowance this year.
Which means people are going to show up at their polling place, maybe with a no party preference ballot, and they'll say, I don't have presidential choices here, and a lot will be happening at the polling places. So those people in place, those volunteers, I think will be quite a bit on duty this
year. They're going to have to answer a lot of questions. Yeah. And I think one really good resource, along with what we've produced, is this step-by-step guide that the California Secretary of State's website has produced. It sort of walks you through, no matter what your party affiliation is, it walks you through what you need to do if you're a Democrat, a Republican, a no party preference voter, and how you can go ahead and vote for the candidate that you want in the March 3rd primary.
Chris, stand by here a second. Daniel, I know this is a bit of a curveball being thrown at you, but outside of California, is there issue, discussion, kind of a navigation of how best to do this, either declined estate category or no party preference? It's called different things in different places. Can you add to this conversation?
So unfortunately, I haven't seen a lot of misinformation about this on social media. We've been tracking certainly voting and primary falsehoods on social media. But from what we've seen, the platforms, including Facebook and Twitter, have been pretty good about taking down falsehoods about voting.
Okay. So in California, the social media around this and other items has, as we've been acknowledging and talking about, kind of pushed towards some other pieces of misinformation, falsehood. One in particular was surrounding Bernie Sanders.
That's right. There was a post that or a video on Twitter that was shared, I think, about 1,000 times or more about Bernie Sanders, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders' name being intentionally placed last on the California ballot. That's just not the case. California has a random alphabetical drawing to determine where the names go on the ballots. And then throughout California, those names are then changed around by assembly district. So in some parts of the state, Sanders' name will appear near the top, other parts near the middle, other parts near the bottom of the ballot. But nothing is done on purpose to put any candidate's name at the top or bottom.
And besides no party preference, the other confusion this year is Prop 13.
There are
the
tons
real Prop
of questions
13,
about that.
The not Prop 13, the what does Prop 13 mean? So go for it. By now you must have figured out a succinct way to explain this.
Right. Yeah. And there's this has probably been, next to the no party preference voting, the biggest source of confusion. So on the March ballot, Californians will find just one ballot measure. It has a familiar but very confusing name. It's called Proposition 13, but it has nothing to do with the historic measure, the property tax measure that was passed in the 1970s with the same name. This new one is a $15 billion school bond. It would help pay for upgrades for K through 12 schools, community colleges, public universities, but again, not connected to that old Prop 13. I think the thing that compounds it is that there has been misleading and false information about the old Prop 13. Mm. That's because there is an effort to qualify a measure for the November ballot here in California, not the March one, but the November ballot. And that, if it's successful, it would essentially change parts of the old Prop 13. It would undo some of the property tax protections for commercial properties, industrial properties of $3 million or more. It would not directly affect homeowners. And the false information is that California is trying to eliminate or repeal that old Prop 13. That's just not the case. There are efforts to change it. But again, that's for the November ballot.
It's not going to be called Prop 13, though.
Right. Well, I think the old one will retain that name. There's even been an effort to retire the number 13 when it comes to these propositions, just to avoid some of this confusion that we're talking about.
So split roll is the phrase to remember for November.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
All right. I'm talking with Chris Nichols. Daniel Funke from the PolitiFact national team is joining us. And Daniel, I want you to jump in here because the area that you've focused on is actually sort of funny, but important. You're looking at satire. How and why is that on your radar?
Yeah, so we have been looking at websites that you might not be familiar with. So we're not talking about The Onion here. We're talking about websites that are claiming to publish satirical content, but this might be made up web content about politics. And these stories aren't self-evidently satire. They're not funny. They don't really contain any nuance, but they're made up stories about political figures. And last month, we published an investigation on PolitiFact.com that found hundreds of websites actually copy those stories and publish them as genuine news. And those websites got hundreds of thousands of engagements on platforms like Facebook. So going into the primary season, these were some of the most popular websites, and they were just copying and ripping off satirical content. They weren't even making anything up to begin with, but a lot of people fell for this stuff.
Isn't some of this work aimed at defining satire and figuring out what exactly to be fact-checking in what category?
Right, of course. It's a really hard distinction because us at PolitiFact don't want to be the tastemakers telling people what is and isn't satire. We're always focused on what our readers want and what they're asking us about. So we will fact check allegedly satirical articles if we have a lot of people either emailing us or sliding into our messages about it or leaving comments asking if it's true, because we see our coverage as a public service and we always want to be providing that information and context to people, even if a website is claiming to be satire.
You're tracking some Facebook pages and trying to figure out where the strongest source of misinformation is. What's coming out of that?
Yeah, so we have started tracking about 300 Facebook pages or groups that have shared content that we fact-checked as false over the past year. And we're still going over those results, but we have seen a couple pages with millions of likes. And these are typically hyper-partisan pages on both the left and the right that will mix just hyper-partisan talking points and campaign rhetoric with sometimes deliberately false information that might have been lifted from elsewhere, whether it be Twitter or websites, and then those will get distributed either through groups or users who are sharing them. So it's still too early to tell which of these pages will have the biggest effect on the primary season, but we are starting to track this, and it's a major driver of misinformation on Facebook.
This is a conversation about voter misinformation. So, Chris, I want to get back to you and the work that the PolitiFact California team has done about President Trump's claims about California voter fraud. What's the investigation been? What are the facts around this?
Well, the president, unfortunately, has made quite a few unsubstantiated and false claims about massive voter fraud in California. Without providing evidence. And, we've, through the last 3 years, just knocked those down as they've come up. I think we've rated them pants on fire about three different times when he's resurfaced the claims, either in an interview last summer on Meet the Press or on Twitter. When you speak with election officials around the state and experts on this topic, they say that there are a minuscule number or cases of voter fraud, and certainly nothing to the idea of massive voter fraud in California.
Daniel, you've looked at Iowa because there was some misinformation spread about voter fraud in Iowa. So what are the facts around this one?
Yeah, so the same day of the Iowa caucuses, an organization called Judicial Watch, which is a conservative organization, published a report claiming that there, in eight Iowa counties, there are more registered voters than there are citizens. We took a look at the data at PolitiFact, and we found that that report is false. They were using outdated information, and there's actually only one county in Iowa among the eight that Judicial Watch identified that has more registered voters than people that live there. But the county had about 2,000 citizens to begin with, and experts told us it's not uncommon to have more inactive voters than citizens. Also, the Iowa Secretary of State came out and debunked Judicial Watch's story, saying that it had found no evidence to back up its numbers. And other experts we talked to echo Chris's point, told us that voter fraud is relatively rare. I think since 2009, but over the past decade or so, there have only been about 20 confirmed cases of voter fraud in Iowa to begin with. So there's no evidence to suggest that this is a widespread problem. And it was no coincidence that Judicial Watch published this report on the same day of the Iowa caucuses. Mm-hmm.
We have been talking about voter misinformation. Daniel, will you add to this some of the work you're doing surrounding the novel coronavirus and the claims which, as this virus moves globally, seem to expand from a lot of different sources? What have you looked at and found to be fact?
Yeah, so PolitiFact has spent the past few weeks fact-checking dozens of false or misleading claims about the coronavirus, and they fall into a few different categories. So first, we have false reports, either about the impact or the reception of coronavirus. So there's a hoax going around that we have rated false that claims that FEMA imposed martial law or asked President Trump to impose martial law in the United States, and that's fabricated. It comes from a hoax website. There was another false claim that said 10,000 people have died from the Wuhan coronavirus, and that is also false. The latest estimates from the World Health Organization put the death toll at about a little more than 1,000 as of yesterday. So those are false claims about impact. Then there are a ton of conspiracy theories about the origin of the virus. False information always proliferates when there's an absence of confirmed information, and there's still much researchers don't know about where the novel coronavirus came from. So a lot of social media users and fringe conspiratorial websites have claimed that it was developed in a lab or that it is a Chinese bioweapon. And we found that there's no evidence to support those claims. These are conspiracy theories that are trying to galvanize the conversation, get some clicks in the process. We're still fact-checking this. It's kind of distracted us from our election coverage a little bit. But we think it's really important to debunk these conspiracies, especially hoaxes we've seen about bogus cures. So we've seen false posts tell people people to drink bleach and that'll ward off the coronavirus. And that's some really dangerous false information. Obviously, bleach does not ward off the coronavirus, and there's no known cure or vaccine for the virus yet.
Yeah, I think with the news cycle being the way it is, we are heavy in the political season, but the coronavirus, I would guess, is driving more people to websites to find factual information right now. Do you have any way of measuring that?
We haven't measured it in terms of numbers, but just anecdotally, I can tell you the majority of the hoaxes that we see through our monitoring tools and both through our monitoring tools and what readers are asking us about is either about coronavirus or Nancy Pelosi ripping up President Trump's speech at the State of the Union. So it kind of gives you an inkling of what people are talking about on social media, because if you have one or a few readers ask you about something, you have to assume that there are hundreds or maybe thousands of people who are wondering the same thing. So that is why PolitiFact has invested so much time in fact-checking false posts about the coronavirus. And also the coronavirus and misinformation about it has a direct impact on people's health, because if people see this hoax about drinking bleach and go out and drink bleach, obviously that's going to have a much more negative impact than some election misinformation. Although both are important, we want to prioritize the former.
Tell me some of what's swirling around about Nancy Pelosi's tearing of the speech. What has PolitiFact looked at?
Yeah, so yesterday we published a story contextualizing a video that President Trump tweeted over the weekend, I believe. It basically shows President Trump honoring all these different guests at the State of the Union address, including military families and a young woman receiving a scholarship. And immediately after those clips, the video shows Nancy Pelosi famously or infamously ripping up the president's speech to make a political statement about how she kind of dishonored the president in that way. A lot of people were sharing it and thinking that, you know, she had actually ripped up the pages after President Trump mentioned those guests during the address, when in fact she waited till the end of the address to rip it up. And she actually stood and clapped for all of those guests. So again, it's not a piece of deliberately false misinformation. It's just a misleadingly edited video that some people received or perceived to be, a slight against the president.
All right, Daniel. Well, thanks for joining us. We'll post a link to, in particular, some of the fact-checking that's been done about the coronavirus, and it will lead people to PolitiFact.com. And we'll stay in touch with you in your ongoing work. Thanks for joining us from St. Petersburg, Florida.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Chris Nichols here still in the studio. I do want to add one election note, and that is that California voters have this track your vote option, and we haven't talked about it, but we should.
That's right. It's called Where's My Ballot? And it's a pretty neat service that the state is offering. It's a new way for voters to track and receive notifications on the status of their vote by mail ballot. And so essentially, voters can go sign up at, I'll mention the website here. It's called wheresmyballot.sos.ca.gov, or if you just search on the California Secretary of State's website, you can find it. And you'll get automatic emails or text messages or voice call notifications about your ballot. And you can be sure that it was actually received and processed. It looks like quite a few counties are participating, including Sacramento, Placer, Yolo, Sutter in our region. It looks like the list does not include every county in the state, but that's one piece of accurate information as opposed to what we were talking about earlier. And then I did want to mention, you know, when it comes to California's primary election, we would like to hear from our audience if they are seeing statements on social media that are confusing, that they feel are misleading when it comes to the election, how to vote, who you can vote for. We'd like to hear from you. Our article today, which is at on the main page of politifact.com and also at capradio.org, includes a way for people to go and ask PolitiFact California to look into things. So please do that. We're happy to look into your questions.
Thank you, Chris.
Thanks, Beth.
Chris Nichols is the reporter with the PolitiFact California team based at Cap Radio. We have posted a link to a lot of what we've talked about. It's at capradio.org/insight. I said during the segment that Deval Patrick was expected to suspend his run for the presidency, and he has, in fact, officially done that. There's much more news on our website. And up next, our show continues. We'll be talking about the youth vote in California. So stay with us. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. So young voters in New Hampshire, at least according to exit polls, seem to have really helped Bernie Sanders. He won more of New Hampshire's young Democratic primary voters than, listen to this, the rest of the field combined. He led in this category of voters age 18 to 29 with 51% of the votes. Every caucus and primary, including California's on March 3rd, is going to put the spotlight on young voters and their power in this election. Kim Alexander's here to help us explore this young vote. She's the founder and president of the California Voter Foundation. Hi, Kim.
Hi, Beth.
Glad to have you back in the studio.
Thank you.
Also with us, Savannah Mendoza. She is the civic engagement coordinator of ASI, Associated Students, Inc. at Sacramento State. Hi, Savannah.
Hi.
Glad to have you here. Samantha Elizalde is Director of Social Services, Social Sciences, and Interdisciplinary Studies of the same group, and she is on the ASI Board of Directors. Samantha, I'm glad to have you here,
I'm glad to be here.
So let's talk about the engagement of young voters. Kim, at this point, what do you know about the youth vote in California?
What I know about the youth vote in California is that we have a lot of pre-registrations going on now, people who are eager to get into the voting process. Secretary of State just issued some data showing that 16 and 17-year-olds are registering. We have about 500,000 registered now. According to Mindy Romero and the California Civic Engagement Project, we have about 3 million 18 to 24-year-olds who are eligible to vote. And Mindy has projected that there could be about over 600,000 youth voters 18 to 24 this election if past trends hold true and what their turnout was in June 2016.
So this option started in 2016. I don't think either of you were in college then. You were in high school.
I was in college.
You were in college then? Right. Yeah. Were you alert to this? Were you excited that as a 17-year-old or even a 16-year-old, you could jump in and register before coming to voting age of 18?
Yeah, no, definitely. And I think it really gets that mindset into young people that, you know, I can register, like I can kind of be a part of something. You know, it may not be like just yet, you know, I still have some time to where I can actually participate, but at least I can be a part of, you know, the system and be, you know, a registered voter, you know.
So. How old were you when you registered, Savannah?
I was 18.
You were 18. Yeah. All right. Samantha, what about you? When did you sort of wake up to the idea that before you were 18, you could somehow step into the process?
Well, personally, in high school, it wasn't something that was spoken about. It was when I started applying to college and getting my interest where I was like, I want to do political science. And my most exciting thing was turning 18 and being able to register to vote. So
both of you have gotten engaged in getting out the college vote. Mm-hmm. And what has that meant? Tell me about the effort, which has been boosted, by the way, by a piece of state legislation. Mm-hmm. So, Savannah?
It's definitely been a great and exciting experience. Getting out the vote has been something that I've been passionate about since I was in high school. So being able to do this while in college has been a very humbling experience in working with students and campus partners. A lot of our efforts consist of doing voter registration tabling throughout campus, like once every other week, working with campus partners like our variety of centers to, you know, encourage students to get out the vote, and then also doing efforts on social media. We also have a very supportive president's office that sends out massive emails to students to remind them to register to vote, about the deadlines, and how to vote on campus.
All that's in that positive, come on, join in, be part of the team.
Yeah.
What are the hurdles? What have you heard, Samantha, when someone doesn't want to stop at the table or says, I'll come back or I'll think about it?
A lot of students are hesitant just because sometimes they just aren't educated on, like, where is my vote going? Does my vote really matter? So a lot of those barriers are just, like, questions of students, like, that they don't really know about voting, or they think that, like I said, their vote doesn't matter. They're just not interested. But it's just letting them know that their vote does matter and letting them know what they will be voting on. So, yeah.
Kim, is any progress being made on that myth, perhaps, of whether a vote matters or not?
You know, I think that as people get into the voting process and they have the experience of voting and voting successfully, it does change. The problem for young people is you have a bit of a chicken and egg problem. Young people are a very small segment of the overall voting population, and their turnout numbers are not historically that great. So political campaigns and political parties look at those stats and they say, well, let's put our resources into messaging to older people and to reaching out to older people. So young people don't see campaigns and parties talking about the issues that they care about. So then they continue to tune out. And that's the cycle that we have to break. And that's one of the reasons why we see the rates of voter registration among young people being trending very high to no party preference. You don't see them attaching themselves to political party, and that can make it more challenging to vote because you're not really sure where you stand. So those are unique barriers. But I do think that social media is really, I know we talk a lot about the potential negative impacts of social media, but the flip side of it is that when it comes to influencing other people to vote and how to vote, friends and family have more influence than anybody else. And now, because of social media, they have the ability to share that influence much more easily. So that does give me hope that through social networking and social media, young people like these women here with us today are able to be more effective in reaching out to their friends and encouraging them to participate.
Samantha, tell me about social media as a factor.
Well, it's a good way to get out, like, information. I know mostly everyone is on social media, so that is good. So when we are trying to use our director platforms, we always try to push the vote on there because that's the most way we can reach students. But even for those who don't have social media, we are out there tabling, letting them know that we are still here.
What would you add to the challenges, Savannah, in terms of reaching people?
I think definitely as students, we're very busy. And that's like the biggest thing that I get from a lot of students is like, even when I'm tabling, like, oh, I'm heading to class right now, whether, you know, and so we're constantly on the move. And I think sometimes getting involved is like the last thing that we think about when we're just trying to get our basic needs met. And when we have these issues of housing and homelessness, accessing food and basic needs, like, yeah, getting civically engaged, we're like, you know, I don't have time to sit down and vote, right? We think it's such a complicated process, and it can be sometimes, but the best thing, you know, that I try to do is reassure students that getting involved in this process will actually help improve parts of your situation. So it is kind of something where, like, you know, we have to remind students and make it more accessible and just easy and a part of the day-to-day routine of being a student and not just like this whole like outside extra thing.
That's Savannah Mendoza. I'm also talking with Samantha Elizalde. They are both from ASI, the Associated Students, Inc. organization at Sacramento State. Kim Alexander is here. She is founder and president of the California Voter Foundation. I made reference to a piece of legislation. So let's talk about Assembly Bill 59 and how it was instrumental in creating these vote centers. What difference has it made to have a vote center on campus?
So the bill that created the vote centers was Senate Bill 450 from 2016, and that is allowing counties that opt into this new voting model to replace polling places with vote centers. Another feature of the new model is there's far fewer vote centers than polling places, but they're open for more days, and you can go to any one of them in your county. So it gives more flexibility. The one at Sac State was extremely popular in 2018. And the other feature of the Voters' Choice Act is that every voter who is registered to vote, except in Los Angeles, is mailed a vote-by-mail ballot automatically, whether they ask for one or not. So the advantage for young people is you are getting a ballot in the mail as long as you're registered to vote. You don't have to ask for one. You don't have to go to a polling place to vote. You can vote by mail. We have postage paid return now statewide. I'm very happy that we made that reform happen in California. The challenge is, I think, for young people moving to this vote model, if you're casting a vote by mail ballot, the burden for getting it right when you vote shifts from the poll worker to the voter. So the voter has to make sure they fill out their ballot properly. And most importantly, they have to make sure they sign the envelope and they have to make sure that they get it in on time. So these are important steps to make sure your ballot's going to get counted. I heard Chris Nichols talking about Where's My Ballot tracking, which is new for many voters this election, which is a great service. We do see vote by mail ballots getting rejected. Top reasons why: they arrive too late to be counted, or the signature on the envelope doesn't match their signature on file. And this is a particular issue for young people because they just have started creating a signature. They may not really have a signature. So we need to encourage them to, if they're going to vote by mail, get it in early, check your voter ID, your driver's license or state ID to see what your signature looks like, and try to make your signature look like that when you sign the envelope. Have a plan for voting. Don't wait to the last minute. And the other thing we have to get out to Sacramento voters and all voters that have vote by mail ballots is open that ballot immediately and look at it, because as you know, we have a lot of no party preference voters. Mm-hmm. Those voters are not going to have presidential candidates on their ballot. They don't want to open their ballot up the night before and discover it's not the ballot that they don't want, you know, to vote. So open your ballot now, get a new ballot, call your registrar. If it's not the ballot that you want, ask them what you need to do.
So I mentioned Assembly Bill 59. So I guess, Savannah, that actually prioritizes college vote centers and makes sure, and every piece of encouragement and support and emphasis on the college is important to all of you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, Sac State was actually the first CSU to have a vote center on campus, and that was definitely a phenomenal effort that was done. And we had great turnout, like she said, in Sacramento County. And so we definitely set the example statewide. And so now other CSUs are looking at us and definitely trying to implement the same thing and to make it more accessible for students. Yeah, we definitely share that with our students. Like, we have a vote center on campus. You can vote here, right here at Modoc Hall. So, and a lot of people are surprised that, you know, like, they didn't know that. So that's something that we're definitely trying to, you know, share with students. And also Samantha and I are working on, you know, like, how do we get students physically here on, you know, during the time that it's open? So we, like, we've been working on a fun project to do so.
So how do you do that? What else needs to be done? You have a couple weeks until the day of the primary, but voting is open now with your ballot.
Yeah, so our office has is actually creating a voter information packet that's going to be sent out to students and accessible to students, and it really breaks down each office and how that impacts students and just what's on the ballot, so, and how we can vote here in Sacramento County. So that's going to be sent out to students, making it accessible when we table, sent out by the president, so why not? So that's what we're doing, sharing on social media. And then Samantha can speak a little bit more on the transportation efforts that we're doing to
which
get
is critical for students.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I know in the 2018 midterm elections, they used actually golf carts to transport students from different areas of campus to Modoc Hall. So this year, to make it a little bit more easier and accessible for a large number of groups to go, we decided to utilize our Hornet shuttles, which are buses that take students from different parts of the outskirts of campus. And this bus is going to be able to take students from different parts, different bus stops to Modoc Hall, so they can go with a bunch of friends and go out and vote. So, and that bus is going to, our campaign name is Buzz the Ballot, just to make it more Sacramento State. So it's going to have a big sign saying Buzz the Ballot on the side of the bus, so students know which bus to take to get them to the vote center.
It's the vote party bus.
Yes. Right? Yes. Yeah, yes. Exactly. Yeah.
That's the way to do it. I mean, I think it's really a great program what's going on at Sac State. And and if you can make voting fun and something that you can do with your friends, we also encourage people to have ballot parties. You know, the ballot's long and complicated. Get together with some friends, go through your booklets and look online together for information. You can go to votersedge.org. You can come to calvoter.org and we'll help you find reliable information. And that's the other good thing, is that there's a lot of great information online, and young people are very adept at using computers and smartphones and technology. So there are great places to tap into to get reliable information online and help each other vote.
I don't know if the two of you know, but Kim's kind of famous for
infamous
for getting her friends together and making songs out of the propositions every year. Yes. So there are all kinds of things you can do to make this a lot of fun. All right, we're going to post some helpful links for everybody. And some of what we're talking about on the Sac State campus is happening in campuses, on campuses across the state. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you.
I hope your turnout is better than ever this year, and I look forward to some follow-up about this.
Yeah, no, thank you.
All right, thanks a lot. That is Samantha Elizalde and Savannah Mendoza from ASI. We'll post a link to ASI, by the way. And Kim, we'll post a link to California Voter Foundation. There's a lot of great information there, and there's still a lot of time to get motivated, get involved, and then cast your ballot. Thanks, Kim Alexander.
Thank you.
So you're listening to Insight on CAP Radio. Up next, wine expert Rick Cushman is going to join me. We'll talk about some changing trends in wine sales and a bit of bubbly advice for Valentine's Day. This is Insight on CAP Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. Valentine's Day is as important for wine, champagne, and fancy cocktails, perhaps, as it is for chocolate, dessert, and an early restaurant reservation. It's a great time to have wine expert Rick Cushman back in the studio with us, and he is here. Hi, Rick.
Happy early Valentine's Day, Beth.
So January was dry January for a lot of people. It was really popular. I wonder if we're going to have a pendulum swing this week to a super bubbly Valentine's Day.
Well, there's probably a lot of people waiting for it. And oddly enough, for those who went to dry January, there's a lot of studies that show that if you haven't been drinking regularly, you know, not regularly crazy, but moderately, that your body's ability to process alcohol has been weakened or at that point of that you will get drunk faster. Actually, that's the warning. So if, you know, if you're coming off your dry January, you're planning to splurge, eat first.
It works
Don't
better.
I sound like a school marm from the old West when I say that.
Yeah, it works better when you give everybody the direct language, though, so we know exactly what we're dealing with. And I always count on Valentine's Day and that coming from you. But before we get deep into this conversation, there is something happening with wine sales across the country. It's not just because of dry January.
Yeah, and actually, Unified Wine and Grape Symposium, which is the largest wine and trade show in the Western Hemisphere, was just here last week. And, you know, and there was a lot of state of the industry stories before that and all kinds of things. And what we found is this has been pretty consistent, is that wine sales are they were up at their lowest rate ever in 25 years. So wine sales have really slowed. And there's lots of reasons for it. And they're having to do with, one, how wine markets itself. And you've heard me complain over and over about this elitism that, you know, wine is for a very special thing and for very special people. And it, of course, it shouldn't be, you know, but so younger people are not drinking wine, but then younger people are not drinking as much beer either, you know, and there's other things that are out there. There's kombucha, hard seltzer is crazy at the moment, but, it, you know, or in terms of growth, but, you know, coming off of almost nothing, so the growth numbers are big. But so what, one of the things that we've seen with wine is that it's kind of reaching a point where its main drinkers, the baby boomers, are kind of aging out of drinking a lot or spending a lot on wine. Mm. And the younger folk are not drinking as much wine or spending as much on wine. And the wine industry had sort of been betting on, you know, the prices rising on what they've been calling premiumization, because for a few years there, people were all moving up, but they sort of tapped out. And so value-wise, volume-wise, all those sorts of things, wine is not doing all that well.
Do we have climate change, wildfire issues,
well,
too?
Well, those are things, other things, too. One other point on that sort of is that to add to that is that they were at Unified, they were just, wine industry was just told that to balance out, because we have a grape glut right now. And the reason is because, and this goes to climate change, which is that the last handful of years were relatively warm, which made for relatively large yields. And so, you know, there was, you know, basically growing seasons were even and warm and steady. And so they got very good yields. And so they've got a fairly large grape glut right now. And in fact, they were told, the Growers Association, that Allied Grape Growers, that sort of oversees all this in California and in the U.S., suggested that they rip out 30,000 of the, I think it's 590,000 acres of grapes that are in California. 30,000 acres is, I think I wrote this down here, it's 47 square miles. That's, San Francisco's 49 square miles.
Wow.
So basically take out San Francisco size amount of grapevines out of California to get even. So that is partly a climate change thing. The industry in Northern California, certainly wildfires have been, well, Southern California too, have been an issue in a little bit in the production, but more in the tourists. Because in regions like Napa, although Napa is its own little animal because it's so expensive and so popular, but Sonoma and Mendocino and Lake County and in Southern California, places like Temecula, where they really live a good part off of the tourism too, and folks think that they're going, you know, from Northern California, that they're going to still go, but people have been canceling trips, you know, because they don't want to go in what they think is either a devastated zone or a danger zone. Sonoma in particular had been hit, and we talked about this last year.
Always encouraging people to go explore and take your business
right
over there.
And right now, so the regions are, especially now is a great time to go because it's winter, but the weather's good and all of those regions. So they've been hit by that too. And so there's a handful of things that are going on that is making it difficult for the wine business, and they're not responding particularly well.
Where do you think this is going to go?
Well, that's a really complicated question. As a consumer, what we won't see, like, they won't see a lot of difference in the supermarket wines, you know, and that's a pretty big range. Everything from that $5 and $6 Chardonnay to the $25 and $30, you know, Cab and Pinot that people buy in relatively in supermarket style stores. The big brands will survive just fine. They'll have access to wine. They'll have they'll manage it. But the little folk, and not necessarily our foothill friends, because they're small enough and they're unique enough, and people go to them. You know, but the sort of small mid-size independent wineries in all throughout California, whether not in Napa, but because there aren't really many small independent, but Sonoma and Mendocino and up the coast and Lake County and down in the Central Coast, those little folks are going to struggle, you know. And we haven't even talked about the tariffs, which can make life more complicated for them too, because distributors who make some of their money off of bringing in foreign wines may be going out, the small ones may be going out of business. So the little guys are going to struggle. So what that might mean for consumers is it might mean eventually higher prices, and maybe a little fewer of the sort of independent brands that they used to see maybe going away. And that's sort of the long run. The short run is, because of this grape glut, there's going to be some pretty good juice out there. So, you know, and you may be seeing, as you go to a restaurant, seeing a brand that you'd never heard of before, or even a Trader Joe's or a Nugget or a Safeway for that matter. And it may well be that one of the, you know, decent sized wineries is offloading their juice into a private brand, or, you know, the brand, the place themselves, like Costco's that make their own wine, may be getting some pretty good juice.
Let's hit two more topics in this. Number one, the tariffs.
Yeah.
And then number two, a little bit of Valentine's
Absolutely.
Day guidance.
Absolutely. Valentine's Day is still good.
So the 100% tariff on French wine is on hold, correct?
Yes, in theory. And probably. And that was the, it was a retaliatory tariff because the French have taxed some tech stuff going in. And it had people terrified because you know, doubling the price would basically kill the market and kill a lot of small distributors. I have a friend who's a small distributor who brings in wine from France.
But that is already decreased. The imports have decreased.
Yes, because there was a 25% tariff, and that was the Airbus thing where the EU was taxing or giving preferential treatment to Airbus, and the U.S. said no anyway. So there's 25% tariffs since October, and that worked badly in a couple ways because it was imposed suddenly. And this is the fear. There's no warning. You know, they're talking about maybe, but that got imposed suddenly. So there was wine on boats that suddenly cost way more to bring in. And so the little guys really got hit. And 25%, they could eat that once, but you can't do it all the time. So the French wine imports are down. I just saw some numbers like 44% since October.
Wow.
And we drink a lot of French wine, especially on the East Coast. It affects us a little less here on the West, but we still drink a lot of French wine here too. So that part is roiling the industry as well.
All right. A minute of great advice for everybody for Valentine's Day.
Well, okay. Prepare to wait. Yeah, this is always a thing.
Wait,
right?
In the restaurant.
Yeah, in the restaurant. Yeah. You're going, no matter what your reservation is, and make one if you haven't made it quickly. But that's okay. And then when you get to the table, take your time. Don't worry about other people waiting, because I just told you to prepare to wait. When you do have to wait, go to the bar, get a glass of bubbly. I always think that's just a great celebratory way to do it. Whatever kind of bubbly you like, you know, it could be Prosecco or Cava or a nice champagne or some sparkling from California. And then there's my other romantic hint. I only have one romantic tip, which is, and frankly, I don't even know if this works, but I tried it once, which is call the restaurant and order a glass of something sparkling for your date and have them deliver it to the table when you sit down. So, you know, you sit down, whether you're the male or the female in this in this relationship right now, is just have them show up with that little glass of wine. You sit down.
Somebody's going to be impressed.
And say, oh, we ordered this for you. Yeah. Or if you know your date likes something else, then make sure it's that wine too. But just have it sitting there waiting for them when they sit down, and shows you're trying.
I love that. Happy Valentine's Day.
Happy Valentine's Day.
To you and Deborah. Thanks so much. Glad to have you here, Rick.
Always a pleasure.
You can find a link to Rick's website, which links you to his podcast at capradio.org/insight. That's Insight for Today. On tomorrow's show, we'll revisit a conversation with Ladysmith Black Mombazo. I'm Beth Ruyak, another live show tomorrow. Thanks for joining us.